I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. General Martin Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, wrote a letter to Defense Secretary Leon Panetta earlier this month, saying that the armed services chiefs all agreed that the time had come to, quote, eliminate all necessary gender-based barriers to service. So last week, Secretary Panetta made this historic announcement that overturned a 1994 Pentagon rule.
Our purpose is to ensure that the mission is carried out by the best qualified and the most capable service members, regardless of gender and regardless of creed and beliefs. If members of our military can meet the qualifications for a job, and let me be clear, I'm not talking about reducing the qualifications for the job. If they can meet the qualifications for the job, then they should have the right to serve, regardless of creed or color or gender or sexual orientation.
About 280,000 women have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, where 152 have died and where more than 800 have been wounded. Women make up about 15% of the U.S. military. Today in Radio Times, we look at this groundbreaking policy, what it means for the military and for the women who serve in the military. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is Beth Bailey, professor of history at Temple University. Her research focuses on the history of gender and sexuality and on war, society, military institutions in U.S. history. Her most recent book is America's Army, Making the All-Volunteer Force. She's also acting director of the Center for the Study of Force and Diplomacy at Temple University. And Beth Bailey, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Joining us by telephone is Colleen Farrell. She's a U.S. Marine Corps captain who was deployed to Afghanistan from 2010 to 2011. She recently left active duty. She's one of the plaintiffs in the ACLU lawsuit challenging the Department of Defense ban on women serving in combat roles. And Colleen Farrell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning. It's an honor to be a guest.
So what was your reaction to Secretary Panetta's announcement last week? What did that mean to you?
Obviously, I was thrilled to hear the announcement about the policy change. It's exactly what our lawsuit was fighting for. And hopefully women can finally start being recognized for the jobs they've been doing for the past decade.
And why were you a party to this lawsuit?
Well, I initially joined because when I had deployed in 2010, there were a lot of roadblocks that myself and one of the other plaintiffs faced. There are a lot of things that put our Marines in unnecessary risk just to comply with the policy.
In fact, you were part of a Marine Corps female engagement team. What's a female engagement team?
That's correct. It was our job to build trust and confidence with the Afghan population, specifically women, which is a group that has often been neglected but is essential for peace there.
And what was your job as you were, I guess, heading up this engagement team? What was your job specifically?
Right, I was a section leader, a platoon leader, so I was in charge of about 20 female Marines who were spread out across our battle space.
And were you shot at or were you in danger in doing this work?
I was in danger. I was never specifically shot at. However, the majority of my Marines were, and they were in and around IEDs. So yes, they received combat action ribbons for their service.
Combat action ribbons for their service. Did you think of this as combat, what you were doing in Afghanistan?
Yes, that's correct. My Marines, it would be two at a time. They would go out on patrols with the infantry units, and they actually lived with the infantry units. So they experienced the same kind of danger that the infantry Marines experienced. I even had a team with a Marine Special Operations Unit.
And I know part of your responsibility was that you had to leave or return to the forward operating base every 45 days. Why did you have to do that, and what was the impact?
Right, and that was to comply with the policy's co-location stipulation. And it just put our Marines at an unnecessary risk, convoying back and forth and taking flights back and forth for no real good reason. It also took them out of operations for up to a week at a time. And sometimes battalion commanders had to reschedule major operations just because my Marines were not there.
You recently left active duty, is that correct?
That's correct, on December 1st.
if you had stayed in the Marines and had been around last week when, or I had been in the Marines last week when Secretary Panetta made his announcement, would you have rethought that decision?
Probably not. It was never my intention to stay in past 4 years. I loved the female engagement team, and if I could have been a member of that, I probably would have stayed on. So that program is done with. So.
And what about this ACLU lawsuit? Is that going forward, even though Panetta made the announcement last week?
Right. So we're not actually sure what this really means for the lawsuit. We hope that the repeal is implemented fairly and quickly.
Well, let me get you in on the conversation, Beth Bailey. From your perspective, perhaps even looking outside at this decision, this announcement last week, what was your response?
I was pleased to hear the announcement. I've been a little surprised by some of the ways in which it's been received in the media and the conversations that I've had with friends and colleagues about it, who tend to think of it as sort of no big deal. It's something that's simply verifying what's already happening and recognizing a situation that already exists. And I think it's a big deal for women in the military who have been seeking to be allowed to serve according to their capacity and their interest and haven't been allowed to compete for those positions. It's not that they're being given the right to serve. They're being given the opportunity to compete for positions and see whether or not they're capable of filling them. But the other thing that struck me is that sense that people keep saying, oh, you know, this is just verifying women have been in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan for years, and this isn't any real change. And the regulations that Colleen is speaking of, absolutely, I agree, they have hampered the ability of women to do their jobs, and women have been doing some amazing things, especially the female engagement teams who have been in danger and who have been serving right alongside with the Marine Expeditionary Units. But in part, the notion that women have been in combat is not quite the same thing as women fighting. For most of the women we're talking about, women have been shot at, women have died and been killed in action, women have faced IEDs. But what we're talking about in part is women joining small ground combat units and going out whose purpose is to seek and engage and destroy the enemy. And so treating it as exactly the same thing undermines what women are seeking to do and the challenges that people in the military are going to face in figuring out how to implement these plans. I think women's records in Iraq and Afghanistan suggest that they will be able to accomplish this, but treating it as if it's no big deal, I think, is the wrong approach.
Because what you're saying is this opens up the opportunity for women to be in direct combat.
Yes.
Fighting in direct combat with the enemy.
Yes. And that's their mission. That's their job. It's not that they're co-located. It's not that they're doing other tasks and in danger. And certainly some women have fought. Certainly they have. But that's not their primary mission at this point. And so it's creating a new set of possibilities for women, but it also is going to be more complicated to implement than simply saying we're recognizing what people are already doing and it's no big deal.
I want to pick up on that, but let me get give you a chance, Colleen Farrell, just to respond to what Beth Bailey had to say. Do you see the significant difference of what she's talking about?
Definitely. However, I do think that, you know, even though women have been attacked, what they're doing in response to that is fighting, and they have done that with, you know, honor, and they've served with valor. So I don't think that there's really too much of a difference. However, I do think that this is a monumental repeal, opening up so many positions to women who are qualified.
Because it seems to me, and I'm not a military person, Colleen, but that requires a different kind of training if you are in direct combat versus the kind of work that you were doing.
No, it really doesn't. We trained with the infantry units prior to deploying, and we tried to have as much of the same training as was physically possible.
Do you want to weigh in on that, Beth Bailey?
Well, I'm not suggesting that I know better than she does, because she obviously knows what she's talking about, and I completely agree with her. I'm simply saying we're talking about 284,000 positions, And what she is doing was really at the edge of what most women were doing in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the question will become how many women will qualify for those positions, how many women will want to try for them. But it was a fundamental restriction on women who served being able to serve to their capacities and interests. There are lots of women who would like to have joined the combat arms. And what she was doing was somewhat experimental, and it was an enormous success. It's enormously important. And allowing more women to be able to fill those roles and to fill other roles enhances the capability of the military.
Secretary Panetta talked about gender-neutral standards, obviously taking, a second look at these standards and trying to figure out if you allow women to apply for or try out for these positions, what will those standards be? How do you see that issue, Beth Bailey?
Well, those people who have been arguing for this change over time, and women have been making this case, and some men have been making this case since the 1970s with the ERA, because the military believed that the ERA, it was passed by Congress with broad bipartisan support. It seemed like it was a sure thing. And so the military, particularly the Army, started trying to figure out what to do about that. So there were hearings about women in combat, and the argument from then on by proponents was that the regulations had to be gender neutral but scientific and empirically verifiable, and that no one who was not capable of serving should be allowed to serve in that position. And that has been a consistent argument on the part of women all the way through. Opposition sometimes comes from people who say they don't believe that a sufficient number of women will be able to meet those criteria. Other opposition has been based on notions of nature and God's plan and cultural understandings. I think that it's going to be a challenge to figure out specifically what the criteria should be that is job specific. But that's the goal.
Colleen Farrell, we're almost up in a break here. I'd love to have you weigh in on that as well. How do you see the standards issue?
Right, and that's one of the biggest criticisms that we face, is that people are saying, now the standards are going to be lowered. That's not what we're asking at all. We're actually asking the exact opposite, and that's just to be treated equal. And, regardless of gender, each and every service member should be evaluated on their own individual merit.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about the announcement last week that the military was ending its ban on women serving in combat positions. So that was made by Defense Secretary Leon Panetta. Talking with Colleen Farrell, U.S. Marine Corps captain who was deployed to Afghanistan from 2010 to 2011. She has recently left active duty as one of the plaintiffs in the ACLU lawsuit challenging the Department of Defense's ban on women serving in combat roles. Also with us, Beth Bailey, professor of history at Temple University. She's also acting director of the Center for the Study of Force and Diplomacy. Give us a call. What do you think? 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. This Valentine's weekend, the Philadelphia Orchestra, under Rafael Frubeck de Burgos, performs Carl Orff's Carmina Burana live in concert. Tickets are available online at philorch.org or by phone 215-893-1999. February 14th, 15th, and 16th, Valentine's weekend at the Kimmel Center, Carmina Burana with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
The days are slowly getting longer, meaning spring is fast approaching. Also approaching is the WHYY Winter Membership Campaign. You can help shorten the campaign by making your donation now. For every 750 donations we receive before January 30th, we'll cut one day off the campaign. That's less on-air fundraising and more news and information. Make your donation to support the WHYY buyback at whyy.org/support.
Trey Parker and Matt Stone became hit animators with South Park and then swept Broadway with Book of Mormon. But deep down, it's always been about rock and roll.
of course, as soon as we found even a small bit of money and fame, we decided we were going to be a rock band. And we rehearsed more than we worked on the first shows of South Park.
That's Trey Parker. He and his partner Matt Stone join us this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. More than 200,000 women are serving in the U.S. military, most of them in the Army, I should say, 74,000, followed by the Air Force, 63,000, Navy, 53,000, and Marines, almost 14,000. And we are talking about the announcement last week by Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, ending the military's ban on women serving in combat positions. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHY. Again, joining us by telephone, Colleen Farrell, U.S. Marine Corps Captain, and Beth Bailey, Professor of History at Temple University. Beth, going back to you, and I read the names of the numbers in the military, mm-hmm. women serving in the military, obviously very different between the Marines and the Army. We were talking during the break, and you were saying it's really a mistake to think of the military when we talk about this issue when there are four different branches.
Yeah, one has to take into account which branch we're talking about. And I mean, which service we're talking about, and then what branch. So, talking about the Air Force versus the Army, talking about the Navy versus the Marines, talking about armor, artillery, aviation. I mean, it's not all the same thing. What's really at issue here are the Marines and the Army. Women have been allowed in combat roles in the Air Force, in aviation. They're on battleships. They're in submarines. This is really about ground combat. And it's going to be easier to implement this in terms of women being physically able to qualify in some fields other than other fields. So probably artillery will be easier than infantry. The physical qualifications are extreme in some fields, and they are less extreme, though still very challenging and heavy in others. And so one of the things in this policy suggests is that by later this spring, the different branches of the military have to come forward with a plan for implementation and also ask for exceptions. Mm. The question is, who's going to ask for what as an exception? And whether that will be then challenged.
Well, I'm curious, Colleen Farrell, as a member of the Marine Corps, do you think there should be exceptions to this ruling?
No, I do not. And like she said, you know, lifting this ban is just a step in a long line of progress. There are still many roadblocks ahead for some career fields like you're speaking of. And she was correct in saying that this is primarily an Army and Marine Corps issue. Which is where most of the ground combat career fields are.
And is there also a question about advancement within the military? If it's hard or impossible to serve in combat, does that close certain positions of advancement, Colleen?
Yes, exactly. Over 80% of generals come from the combat arms. So it really matters once you're getting up there in higher ranks.
Do you agree with that, Beth Bailey?
Oh, absolutely. I think the statistic is that women are actually overrepresented in the officer rank compared to the percentage in the military, but only 7% are general flag officers. And women obviously are a relatively small percentage, you know, 14-15% across the military. So it is an enormous issue in terms of women's advancement.
Colleen, and this is an argument I'm sure you've heard before, that generally speaking, men are bigger, they're heavier, they tend to be stronger than the average woman. Is that an issue, and how should the military, or perhaps even how should the Marines deal with something like that?
Right. So in general, men are probably larger and stronger than women in general. Mm-hmm. However, what we were asking with this lawsuit was that each and every service member be evaluated on their own individual merits. So, you know, there are women who are stronger than some infantry men, just like there are some infantry men who are stronger than some women. So we're just asking that, everyone be given a fair shot to compete for those slots.
Does that make sense, Beth Bailey?
That's the clear argument that's being made, and that's the absolute intention here. it may go to parallels in civilian law, where if such a tiny percentage of people can qualify for a position, they say we're not going to open that position to, you know, people of that category. But we don't know that yet. And, I mean, obviously, gender, you know, we talk about men and women, but there's a continuum in terms of size and a continuum in terms of physical strength. So, you know, this is an experiment in some ways, but women have been proving themselves steadily over time, and things have been opening. I think the complication is when we go past the physical standards and move into the intangibles. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion about what those intangibles and cultural issues will mean as this happens. That's the other thing that the military has to think of in terms of training, but also in terms of being able to have honest conversations about what's working and what's not.
And by intangibles, what do you mean?
The culture of combat, what it's like to be in combat, you know, she can speak to this, having experienced it as opposed to simply training. You know, people I know who are in the Army and have, you know, done training say it's a very difficult process. They're not necessarily completely pleased with the process with men. Will it be different integrating women? They have to figure this out.
Do you agree with that, Colleen?
Yes, you know, we're hoping that this policy change will, you know, have a huge impact on the male-dominated culture of the military.
Well, let me see what looks like Rick from Bethlehem has to say. And Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
I'd just like to ask a question about how they would feel, I mean, knowing that some of the elite units in the military, like Pat Tillman, for example, he said it was the hardest thing he ever did to get into the Rangers. How, if him being an NFL football star and, like, the best of the best of the men, most of them wash out, what's still going to be the political reaction when, if we keep the standards the same, women aren't making it in? Do you think there's going to be pushback to lower the standards because it is so difficult even for the best of the men to make it through?
Rick, let me see what Colleen Farrell has to say. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Colleen, what do you think?
Yeah, that's a great point. No, I don't think so. You know, every senior official who has spoken about this policy change has said the standards will not be lowered. So I don't think they're going to compromise if that's not working.
Do you agree with that, Beth Bailey? I mean, certainly that's what Leon Panetta said last week, which is the standards will not be lowered.
Yeah, I think that's the absolute intention. I think that things are a little more complicated in terms of implementation because this is something that the Army and the military in general needs to make succeed. And sometimes it's hard to voice reservations when one doesn't want to be branded as sexist or chauvinist or whatever because there are people who are just ideologically opposed. So creating a realm in which people can speak honestly and not feel that their career is at risk if they raise concerns, which is not the same thing as trying to unfairly block women's access, is one of the challenges that they're going to face. But I think that there are a lot of people who really are committed to trying this, to making this fair. And the military does have a good record in this history.
Rick, thanks for the call. Let's see what looks like Casey from Philadelphia has to say. And Casey, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.
I just had one kind of comment to make. You know, I'm kind of just curious because the whole, there's, you know, women's rights to have, they've been fighting for equality for a really long time. And I thought we, you know, as a country, as a civilization, have kind of gotten to the point where, you know, women have the same freedom to be able to do anything that a man would be able to do. And if they could pass the same test, then what's, you know, then why should there be any sort of political or cultural reason to suppress them of being able to make a choice that a man would have likewise be able to make? So it just seems a little counterintuitive to what we as a culture are trying to attain here.
Oh, well, Casey, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Colleen Farrell, let me give you a chance to respond. Go ahead.
Sure, that's a great point. You know, I grew up in the culture where, you know, I had unlimited options. There wasn't anything that I couldn't do just because I was a female. And then upon entering the Marine Corps, all of a sudden they said, you know, you can't do this simply because you're a female. It doesn't matter if, you know, you can pass a test. You just can't compete because of your gender. So that's what we're hoping, you know, this policy change will really affect.
Are we talking about a generational shift, do you think, Beth Bailey?
Yeah, I think some of it's a generational shift. Just as they found in talking about repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, or taking Don't Ask, Don't Tell at the table, people's attitudes have changed. And I think it's something women have grown up expecting to be able to do whatever they're capable of doing. And I think a lot of men have grown up expecting women to do the same. That isn't to say that there aren't a lot of men who have been in extreme combat situations who from a principled position, are really concerned about this move. And I think we have to allow that there are people who are taking, from a principled position, have concerns, as opposed to people who are simply chauvinist or misogynist or sexist. It's hard to have those conversations, and I think that's why I go back to that thing where people say, oh, it's no big deal. We do need to acknowledge that this is a significant shift, and we need to be able to talk about its implications and to try and figure out how to implement it properly.
And that's Beth Bailey joining us along with Colleen Farrell. We are talking about the decision, the announcement last week, ending the military's ban on women serving in combat positions. Colleen's going to leave us in a moment or two. We'll be getting a third guest in on the conversation. And we do want to hear from our callers at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Colleen, we read about, we hear about the levels of sexual harassment, even sexual assaults within certain branches or parts of the U.S. military. Do you think this lifting this ban will have an impact one way or another on that particular problem?
Right, I do. Sexual assault is a huge problem in the military. A Marine is their own brothers and sisters' keeper. You know, they're responsible for keeping the Marine to their left and to their right, safe, regardless of gender. And sexual assault, I feel, is about dominance. So with the change in this policy, we hope that women will finally be treated as equals.
What do you think, Beth? Do you see a connection at all between these two issues?
Yes, I think there's a connection, and we don't know what impact it's going to have. The hope is that it will have exactly that impact, that it will remove the distinction between the warriors and women, and that it will create a situation of equality and undermine that dominance. Some people have proposed that this will simply exacerbate the problem. We don't know, but the official stance is that people believe it's going to help, and that's my hope.
Let me see what that looks like. Tom from, is that Stowe, has to say. And Tom, go ahead. You're on Radio Times, I think. Yes, there we go. Hi, Tom. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi
there.
I served 8 years in the National Guard. I'm 51. I grew up in the 70s. I'm all for equal rights. So I want to put it bluntly. Menstruation in the field, how are you going to get men to not be queasy about it? I know women have no problem. I did my basic training alongside a battalion of women, and they were awesome. But men are gonna be queasy about it.
Well, Tom, let me give Colleen Farrell a chance to weigh in on that. What do you think, Colleen? Is this a problem?
First off, Tom, thanks for your service. I think that it's a fact of life. The Marines on my team in Afghanistan lived in the same exact small bases. They did without the showers, toilets, cots, and amenities, just because their priority, like all Marines, is to accomplish the mission. So it's not really a factor. I know countless, there's thousands of women who had lived in these conditions, and it was never an issue.
Do you think this is an issue, Beth Bailey? I mean, obviously Tom served and had some concerns.
Well, what he said is men will be queasy about it, as opposed to women can't function because of it, and those are two separate issues.
Right.
The cultural changes may take some accommodation. White men were queasy about serving with black men for a long time. There's been a lot of concern in the opposition to gay men serving openly about the cultural implications. Menstruation is probably easier for men to deal with because they don't have to deal with it directly. But there is a lot of talk about the sanitary issues and such. How will a woman who is in a tank be able to urinate because she can't go in a bottle? And there are technological solutions that people have come up with. These are some things that have to be addressed, but they don't overcome the question. That's not the final answer, is menstruation and whether or not you can squat or stand up to pee.
Colleen Farrell, of course, issues of privacy and, as Tom said, of sanitation as well. But I assume this is in a sense what happens when you serve in an outhouse far away from the United States.
Right, exactly. I mean, you know, like I said, you know, thousands of women have been in this position and they served honorably and without any issue.
So where do you think that your lawsuit is going to go from here, Colleen?
Wait, well, we're not actually sure. Like I said before, you know, it's just a step in a long line of progress, and we hope that it will be implemented fairly and quickly.
And the other women that are part of this lawsuit, I'm assuming that you all are still in conversation?
Yes, that's correct.
Let me go back to you, Beth Bailey. We're still trying to figure out some of the phone callers here. Looking at the U.S. military, what's interesting is that they've been able to integrate the military, lifting of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and now we're talking about women in combat. Do you think it's easier to bring about some of these social changes in the military than it is in the civilian world?
I'm not sure if easier is the right word, but the military, I mean, particularly the Army, which is what I know the most about, had to confront these issues in ways that many civilian institutions didn't have to confront or could walk around for a long time. So with racial integration and then with the expansion of the number and roles of women in the military, the social movements of the 60s played out in the military perhaps more than any other institution in American society. And often it wasn't because the Army said, we want to integrate, we want more women, whatever. They were ordered to do so. But once ordered to do so, the ways in which they worked to implement and the successes that they achieved are really striking.
Let me get to, it looks like Clinton from Williamstown, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. And Clinton, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. How
Love
are you?
Show, by the way.
Thank you.
I just wanted to bring up a point that no one's really talking about, and that is, what about the men? And I had 12 years experience with a section sergeant in a scout platoon. I was a 19 Delta, and our commanders felt that we should have a woman embedded with us for searching other females over there to kind of just keep that at a man's hand so we couldn't be accused of anything. So we had a female join our platoon who was physically apt and capable. She was just a very rough and tough girl.
Right.
She started training with us when we were gearing up to go over for the invasion. And she had some hard times, but she made it through the training. But once we got to Iraq, an unforeseeable thing happened. It wasn't her that was having the problem. It was so much as the men. My men started going out of their way to protect her. Now, my question is, how do we, as a society who tells men, protect, 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 she's being raped, her purse is stolen, protect her. Now my men were starting to do things they normally wouldn't do, run and put themselves in situations where they could die to keep her out of those situations.
Well, Clinton, it's really an excellent call, and we have to take a very short break, and I'm going to hold on to Colleen Farrell just to give her a chance to respond to that. I appreciate the call to Radio Times raising, I think, a very important question. We are talking about last week's lifting of the military ban on women serving in combat positions, talking with U.S. Marine Corps Captain Colleen Farrell, Beth Bailey from Temple University, and we'll get a response to Clinton's question after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Plymouth Meeting Friends School supports WHYY. Serving pre-K through 6th grades, Plymouth Meeting Friends School is a Quaker school that provides a vigorous global education in a small, caring community. Serving Northwest Philadelphia and Montgomery counties since 1780, Plymouth Meeting Friends School is currently processing applications for 2013-2014. Personal tours are available daily. To schedule a tour and to learn more about their integrated curriculum, 610-828-2288, extension 228, or pmfs1780.org.
The abuse and murder of civilians was far more common in the Vietnam War than most Americans imagined, according to a new book by Nick Terse. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Terse about his book, Kill Anything That Moves. It's based on extensive research in military archives and interviews with both military veterans and Vietnamese civilians. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Why do people make decisions they regret 10 years down the road? Like getting that tattoo or rushing to marry that certain someone? New research says many of us underestimate how much will change in the future. We pretty much believe who we are now is who we'll be tomorrow. And we think this knowing that we have changed a lot in the past. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, what research tells us about our future selves. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're talking about last week's announcement by Defense Secretary Leon Panetta announcing he was ending the military's ban on women serving in combat positions. Colleen Farrell, we have to say goodbye to you, but I want to give you a chance to respond to Clinton's question and concern, saying that from his experience, he saw men wanting to protect women out in the field or even in combat, and concerned that this desire to protect them would impact, the safety and security of everybody.
Right. Clinton, first of all, thank you for your service. And I think as, you know, this policy is implemented and women are being treated more and more like equals, this idea that, you know, women are a liability will fade away. When I deployed, we only had about 3 months of actual, you know, infantry tactic training before we deployed. Whereas the infantry patrolmen that were going out on these patrols with my Marines, you know, that's what they've been training for since day one as they entered the military. So, you know, with this change in the policy, hopefully, you know, women will become less of this so-called liability.
Well, Colleen Farrell, thank you for your service, and thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
It's been great to have you on. Also, and staying with us, Beth Bailey, professor of history at Temple University, acting director of the Center for the Study of Force and Diplomacy. Joining us now is Elaine Donnelly, president of the Center for Military Readiness, an independent nonpartisan public policy organization specializing in military and social issues. And Elaine Donnelly, nice to have you with us on Radio Times
nice
as well.
Nice to talk with you.
Nice to talk with you as well. You called Leon Panetta's announcement last week reckless. Reckless how?
Yes, well, he's cut Congress right out of this equation, even though under the Constitution, Congress should be making these decisions. And they have not shared with Congress the research data that was gathered last year. They're just rushing it on through. The chiefs really don't have any say in this. And the primary argument that keeps being made is, first of all, women have been in combat, but we need to define that. Combat that we're talking about now is direct ground combat, the units that attack the enemy. So although it's very true, and we're proud of the women who have served in harm's way, women have not been in the kind of combat units, mm-hmm. the battalions that we're talking about now.
Well, and that's
the tip of the spear. The second major point that's being misconstrued is the idea that standards will not be degraded, tough standards for the combat arms. And we know that's not true because, well, there's several reasons, seven reasons to be exact.
Well, give us one because I want to go back and forth and also get Beth Bailey back in on the conversation.
Sure. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, said if a particular standard is so high that a woman can't make it, the burden is now on the service to come back and explain why is it so high. I'm quoting him. Since the stated goal, and this is me speaking, is to set women up for success, the answer will be no. This standard will change. This is the way it's happened historically, especially when you go for what the general also mentioned, a critical mass, a certain number of women. We're not talking about the exceptional few. Now, critical mass is a phrase from sociology. It usually means 10 to 15%, even if they went for half of that. There's no way you can do it if you don't lower the standards. The third reason is the Military Leadership Diversity Commission. This was a Pentagon advisory committee set up by Congress and the Pentagon, endorsed by the Pentagon, and they are calling for diversity metrics. That means quotas. And the MLDC report says this is not about treating everyone the same. This can be a difficult concept to grasp, especially for leaders who grew up with the EO-inspired mandate to be both color and gender blind.
Okay, so I got to stop you there only because I do want to give Beth Bailey a chance to weigh in. And Beth, you were telling us that, as Elaine Donnelly was saying, is that being in direct combat is not the same thing as being in a sort of support position, even though you might be in the line of fire. So I think there's some agreement between the two of you on this. But do you see this as a reckless decision on the part of Leon Panetta?
No, I don't see it as reckless. And I think that there is an extensive amount of time allowed for figuring out how to implement the programs. This is something that's been happening gradually. What happened initially is that women have been co-located in opposition to the regulations because, as Colleen was just saying, women are filling roles that are necessary and were put at unreasonable risk because of the regulations that prohibited them from being co-located. This goes beyond that. Right. This is definitely going beyond that. But there has been a steady move of opening up more military occupational specialties to women. And there's a lot of attention being paid to how to do this.
But do you see, as Elaine Donnelly sees and has concern about, that this would lead to quotas and somehow lowering the standards?
I don't think so. I think that's something that people have to pay attention to. I think that it's naive to simply say, oh, no, of course, that will never happen. Because
Beth,
it is political.
Wait, hold on, Elaine.
Have you read the diversity report?
I think that your arguments often are disingenuous. And
have you read the diversity report? Well, the answer is right there.
Elaine, hold on one second. I'll give you a chance. Let me give Beth Bailey just a chance.
I assume you did not then.
Well, hold on. Let's find out. Go ahead.
No, I haven't, and I am not making an argument in response to what you're saying. I'm saying that simply announcing that this is reckless is not taking into account the process that's been going on and the process that's foreseen. But I am saying that it is something that needs to be paid attention to because simply saying that it's an easy process or that there will be no political pressure is naive.
Go ahead, Elaine.
Yes, I'd like to finish my points if I could. The diversity report has called for a chief diversity officer, or CDO. This CDO person is mentioned all through the report, and the job will be to enforce diversity management. This means, and this is specified, a criteria for nomination and confirmation to 3- and 4-star ranks and all through an officer's career will be support for diversity metrics. That's another word for quotas. Okay, so that's reality. The Pentagon has endorsed this concept, this report. That's the way it's going to work out, even though many people, well-meaning people, and probably including Beth, believe this will not happen, it's going to happen. Because if officers do not push and promote diversity management and the critical mass that the general Dempsey spoke of the other day, then their careers will be impacted. In fact, the report says they will be held accountable for diversity management and rewarded for efforts. The converse is if they don't do that, then they will be punished. So that's reality. And we know the next commandant, the next chief of staff of the Army, they will be selected by this standard that they must support diversity as a strategic imperative. That's what Admiral Mullen used to call it. So we have to face up to this, and Congress needs to pay attention because so far they've been screened out of the process. That's why I use the word reckless.
Okay.
Then we have to look at gender-free training. The mandate has been given that there should be gender-free training. Well, the Army is already struggling with this. They haven't been able to do it even in the basic PT test. If they try to do it in the tough infantry training and ranger training, then you're going to have to compromise the standards. And it won't be announced in advance. It'll be done by taking out the tougher elements that women cannot do. And then it will be equal, but it will not be the same.
Well, let me just stop you there, and let me give Beth Bailey a chance to respond to this. And what I hear Elaine Donnelly saying is that looking forward, we're going to lower standards, we're going to have quotas, and we're going to reduce the kind of military readiness that we have relied on in the past.
I think that the Army has paid, speaking of the Army, has paid a lot of attention to the cultural implications of integration, whether it be racial, gender, or sexuality, and has tried to figure out how to manage the issue of diversity. And it's something that requires management. It's not something that happens without attention. Quotas is a scare word, and I think, though, that if there is not attention paid to this issue and how to accomplish the assigned task, there is no prayer of success. In terms of standards, it's a concern. It's something that people have to pay attention to, but that is not the goal, and I don't believe that people are quick to say we're going to lessen the standards. I think it may be more job-oriented, specific task-oriented, instead of across the board, and it may have something to do with recruiting and the pre-screening that takes place.
But do you think that there should be a look at standards and even a modernization of standards? And there are many different kinds of jobs in a military and even in a combat unit.
This is going to require the military in different branches, different fields, to examine their standards and to come up with standards that are job-specific. I don't think that requires lowering standards. They may discover that only Olympic-class athletes can qualify for certain things, and they'll say that women are not going to be able to compete for those jobs. But I don't think that's going to turn into a lowered standard for infantry. You just can't do it.
Elaine, you want to respond to that?
Are you familiar with General Robert Cone, C-O-N-E? He has TRADOC, Training and Doctrine Command.
Why do you ask?
He said in a recent interview that what the Army will do is implement fair standards. Fair is not the same as equal. There's no such thing as fairness in battle. It's not fair. It's not equal. It's not even civilized. Our enemies, North Korea, North Africa, Iran, they're not going to be fair to our troops. When you hear the general, this is the guy who's going to determine whether or not women can or should be assigned to the infantry and special operations forces. We're talking about the guys from Point de Hoc to Mogadishu to Baghdad to Fallujah. This guy is thoroughly steeped in the diversity agenda. This is very, very strong in the Pentagon. And by the way, speaking of the Olympic-class athletes, we watched wonderful Olympics this summer. Women were not competing against men. And we're going to watch the Super Bowl next week. The NFL teams don't go for diversity by putting female players on their teams. They do that because they want to win. And it's non-lethal combat. In lethal combat, why are we trying to pretend that men and women are interchangeable when we know very well they are not? I've got another point.
Well, hold on 1 second, only because we're almost out of time. Let me give Beth Bailey a chance to respond. I want to get Raphael from Burlington to join us. Beth Bailey, I mean, do you think the military would lower standards to meet a quota and even jeopardize the safety of troops?
I think fair means job specific. I don't think fair means outcome. And I think that this the diversity agenda tends to give me a sense for what's going on in terms of Elaine Donnelly's argument, because she's been involved in arguing against gays serving openly in the military extensively and also about opportunities for women's service. I think it's critically important that the standards remain job-specific and appropriate, and I think that it's important that the intangible pieces of training and evaluation matter, that it's not only physical involved, but I think that this argument is coming out of a different set of understandings about women's proper roles.
I don't think you've done all your research.
Hold on, Elaine. Just make your point.
Yeah, and a lot of this is new information. We just published it. But you know why racial integration worked in the military? And it's a success story for the ages. The military was way ahead of the civilian world. It worked because everyone was held to exactly the same standard. Nothing was changed. There was no need to. Racial differences were irrelevant and based on prejudice. Prejudice was eliminated when everyone had to meet the same standard. It has not been that way with women, and we're already seeing it. Here's some more information.
Hold on 1 second, only because I
keep interrupting me.
I do,
but tell you something.
Well, I do, but when you have 4 and 7 and 8 points to make, I do want to get Raphael from Burlington, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. And Raphael, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi
there.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Hello. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm a member of the Army National Guard right now in the United States Army Infantry, and I think that it's great that we're having this conversation, but my only issue is when I'm deployed overseas, if I'm going to have to worry about a member of my team not being able to do the job, Currently, right now, I'm a squad automatic weapons operator, and I have to carry 600 rounds of ammunition, you know, a spare barrel bag, weapon system itself, water, my armor plate, food. I have to carry all that equipment. It's a lot of equipment. You know, you're talking in excess of 70 to 80 pounds. Now, I'm a big guy, so it's not too bad, but it really wears down on you. My issue is the standard right now that I have on my PT test, physical training, is to do 42 push-ups in under 2 minutes. Now, a female, same age group, has to do something in the range of 13 push-ups, but she still has to be expected to do the same job as I do. How do we rectify that difference? And how do we make it, are we talking about making it equal or just allowing for exceptions just so that we're showing, as a public policy kind of issue, that we're equalizing the standard?
Well, Raphael, I appreciate your service and your call, and I'm going to give each of our guests 30 seconds to respond. Elaine Donnelly, go ahead.
Raphael's absolutely right, and the answer to his question is the only way to manage this is to lower the standard and pretend that women can do the same as men. And thank you for your service, Raphael. The Marine Corps had two women who tried out on the infantry officer course. They did not succeed. They tried as hard as they could. We respect that. They also did a set of tests for common standards. They started out with six, but after the diversity report came out, they cut it back to three. And they took the toughest ones out and made the ones remaining less intense than they were before.
Go ahead, Beth Bailey.
Gender norming and lowering standards.
Hold on, Elaine. I gave you 30 seconds. I'm going to give Beth Bailey 30 seconds as well. Go ahead, Beth.
I think what's important to remember is that there are different tasks and there are different combat roles that people can play, and they will be standard specific. And if it turns out that virtually no woman can meet the requirements to serve in ground combat units in the infantry, then that will be the conclusion. The notion that this is all about destroying America's military capability, I think, is a bizarre take on it.
Well, we have to end our discussion. Beth Bailey, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. Professor of History at Temple University, Elaine Donnelly, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
President of the Center for Military Readiness, and we also spoke with Colleen Farrell, U.S. Marine Corps Captain. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for those phone calls as well. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back.